This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. A northern Jasper County school district is going to have the benefit of seeing some high-speed internet access come to the district, and it's all part of a new initiative that's been put together by the Purdue Research Foundation. To tell us more about it, we have the PRF's Chief Innovation and Collaboration Officer, David Broker, with us. And David, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks, Chris. My pleasure to be here.
If you will tell us a little bit more about Innovation Partners Institute, it's a creation of the PRF, and how is it helping out in Northwest Indiana to help bring a better connectivity to this particular area?
The Innovation Partners Institute is an institute where what we're trying to do is we're trying to solve big community problems by bringing together people, resources, and collaborators. What we found, and when you study innovation, you realize that it takes a village. You know, it takes a community of people working together to really solve big problems, and that's certainly the case when it comes to rural broadband and connectivity to provide e-learning opportunities for kids. And so the Innovation Partners Institute is bringing together a person. His name is Mo Sakuri. He's an expert out of the Silicon Valley area. He leads the Silicon Valley Joint Broadband Community Initiatives out there. We found him, so to speak, because his brother is a professor at Purdue. And he's bringing a lot of expertise in putting together a network alongside some other industry partners, Watch Communication and SBA Wireless in particular. And then we've also been able to bring together a philanthropic donor. Jay Stead is his name. He and his wife he is a Purdue graduate. Mm-hmm. He lives in New Zealand, and he got this whole thing started when we talked about needing some seed money to kick off this initiative. So we were able to partner across all of those organizations, along with Mo Sakuri, to bring rural broadband and the development of this new network to the Kankakee Valley School District to help solve their broadband problem.
Now, as we mentioned in the past, Pew Research Center has done a lot of research into the issues of the lacking of internet access, particularly in rural areas. What interested you all about the Kankakee School Corporation in trying to help them in this particular project?
Well, it was actually very interesting because one of the things that I've also been leading for the past 6 or 7 months is the whole Safe Campus initiative at Purdue University. So thinking through the problem of what did COVID represent in terms of the challenge, and how do we bring back the 40,000 students to West Lafayette and the Purdue campus. And we also recognized that those same challenges exist in primary K through 12 educational systems. And so we started to work and reach out to the rural educational community, so to speak, in our neck of the woods, even though Kankakee Valley is two counties away from where Purdue is. We reached out, and their superintendent, Don Street, said, "We would love to work with you." And so we found some other schools as well, and we put together this grant that we made to the state. And it's part of the governor's what's called the GEAR program, Governor's Emergency Educational Relief Fund. And between the philanthropic donors, dollars from Jay Stead, the state money, and bringing together this group of people and a school system that really needed it, we were able to get a project launched. So it's now a $1 million project. We're going to bring, if you look at the Kankakee Valley School District, there are probably close to 3,400 students, 2,500 households, and what we hope to do is to bring better connectivity to about 20% of those households.
But within this initiative, what can you hope to do as far as the Kankakee School Corporation is concerned to help boost their internet access? You mentioned about wanting to serve a number of the households, and is that something that the communications carriers are going to be able to take care of?
Yes, Watch Communications is a progressive communications company here in the Midwest, and along with SBA Wireless, which has some wire towers, they're able to broadcast what's called CBRS spectrum. Mm-hmm. This is an important new part of the spectrum that's becoming commercially and publicly available. It's all part of the future 5G build out of small networks. And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to get some experience you know, as the Innovation Partners Institute, we're not there to make money on, you know, commercializing this or turning it into an operating platform, but Watch Communications and SBA Wireless are. So we needed to sort of put together a proof of concept and a demonstration project. And again, the problem of e-learning became the way to do that. And so we're bringing what's called a CBRS private network to the school system for these approximately 500 families, kids and families, and it will be essentially a network for them to do e-learning off of. Once we get this established, it's the type of network that can be used for other things, whether that's e-health, telemedicine, other sorts of civic-minded applications and things like that. But, you know, at the Innovation Partners Institute, we like to talk about we have to go from zero to one idea to proof of concept. That's the zero to one step. And so that's really what we're doing using the problem of e-learning for the Kankakee Valley School District.
Now, you mentioned a little earlier in our conversation that there are other school districts that you're trying to get involved in this initiative. Are there any others here in Northwest Indiana or nearby that that you hope to be able to link up in the same way?
We're trying to see what we can do to leverage this collaboration with SBA Wireless and Watch Communications. So, yes, so there are some other schools that we've started to do outreach to see what we might be able to do in that area. You know, what's fascinating for me, Chris, and again, maybe a side note, but I think an interesting one. When we look at what we're doing out of Purdue today, my colleague and I, we went to the Kankakee Valley School District board meeting. And they were talking about how Purdue, back in the 60s, used to fly airplanes.
That's right.
And broadcast television for educational purposes. And these planes would take off from Purdue University, fly around the state, broadcasting sort of the upper third of Indiana to bring, back then, a new technology platform to rural, America in Indiana. And I was telling President Daniels this the other day. It's like, you know, look how far we've come. The challenge is still the same. The problem, is still the same, but the technology set is different, right? Instead of flying airplanes, we're looking at bringing, the CBRS spectrum. We're working with different, providers like SBA and Watch. And so I just find it fascinating that, 50 years ago, the innovation that we used was what it was. And today we're trying to apply a different set of technologies to solve the same problem.
Well, that's right. And well, back then, for people that may not be aware of it, back then, Purdue University was the sponsor of this project. They would have a plane with a TV antenna, transmitting antenna, sticking out the bottom of the plane. It would fly in a circle 8 pattern all across that section that they were servicing. So this way, school districts and the classrooms could actually tune into television sets to that particular channel and be able to catch their classes that way. It was an interesting concept of physically connecting students with education by way of television.
Exactly. And so now what we're doing is with these new networks that we can use, leveraging this new spectrum, as I said, called CBRS spectrum. So it just has almost come full circle.
Now, you mentioned that you have
to help solve a big problem.
Now, you have a timetable here of January 2021 here. Are you hoping that that things will be going for the initiative by then? And if so, how soon might the new technology be available for these the families and for the classrooms?
We want to get deployed as fast as possible. So we're doing still a little I-dotting and T-crossing in terms of a few little contract things that we have to take care of. But our plan is to roll out as fast as we can in January. So we hope that maybe by the end of January, first part of February, we'll have the initial set of these systems in place, starting to broadcast the connectivity. And we're anticipating this is going to be a hybrid learning challenge, certainly through the spring semester of next year. And we hope that it doesn't happen in the fall semester of next year. But you never know with the way the COVID situation is occurring. So this is going to be an important thing, not just for, the first 3 or 4 months of the calendar next year. We think that it's really going to be an important thing for all of next year.
David Broker is the Chief Innovation and Collaboration Officer with the Purdue Research Foundation based in West Lafayette. And PRF is working together with their Innovation Partners Institute on an initiative that will put team members together and bring wireless broadband connectivity to the Kankakee School Corporation. And David, thank you for being with us to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
People who have diabetes are at a much greater risk of dying from COVID-19 or developing severe symptoms and complications. Now, researchers are finding that many serious problems can be triggered by COVID's impact on blood sugar levels. From Side Effects Public Media, Farah Ustri reports.
I love you. So many germs. Kids are yucky.
Agatha Walston leads a busy life. She's a nurse in southern Indiana and a single mother of two young kids. Still, she's kept control of her type 1 diabetes for over 28 years. But when the pandemic hit, she feared that could be unraveling.
I sat down with him and I said, okay, there's this super killer virus on the loose, and I'm a nurse, and I will probably get it. That was a really hard conversation to have with the kids to make sure that they knew that, you know, if mom goes, they're still going to have each other. I'm sorry.
People living with diabetes are not more likely to get COVID-19, but they're at a much greater risk of developing severe symptoms and complications. A COVID study in England examined more than 20,000 deaths and found that a third of those people were diabetic. In mid-April, Walston tested positive. She survived without hospitalization, but months later, she noticed new health issues. She was diagnosed with high cholesterol, elevated blood pressure, heart problems, and glaucoma, a condition that could cause blindness.
The glaucoma specialist, he had said, you know, you're already at risk for glaucoma, so we won't know if it was COVID or diabetes.
Walston's other doctors are unsure if COVID is behind any of these complications or if her diabetes was a contributing factor. But Walston is far from the only diabetic battling health complications from a COVID infection.
So even if your blood glucose control is perfect, you're still going to have some risks.
This is Dr. Carmela Evans-Molina, director of the Diabetes Research Center at Indiana University. She says that COVID has the power to elevate blood sugar levels and cause insulin resistance even in previously healthy people. And for diabetics, this effect is magnified.
So they might then need changes in their insulin regimen or changes in their diabetes medication. If they're in the hospital, obviously their providers in the hospital will be taking care of these things. But if they're recovering from COVID at home, they need to be very careful in checking their blood glucose very frequently and then be in communication with their doctors as well.
She says that such drastic changes in blood sugar levels could cause long-term complications if not managed carefully.
Well, we realized quite early on in the pandemic, during the course of the pandemic, that there was a bidirectional relationship between COVID and diabetes.
Dr. Francisco Rubino is a professor at King's College London. In a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine, he and other healthcare professionals noted that the severe insulin resistance caused by COVID might have another shocking effect.
Even people who didn't have any history of diabetes coming up to the hospital with clear signs of having diabetes.
Rubino says data is still limited, but there seems to be cases, and he set up a global registry called COVID-DIAP to track them. Back at her lab at Indiana University, Dr. Evans-Molina's team studied pancreatic cells of patients who passed away from COVID, and she says they did not see evidence of the virus being able to cause new onset diabetes.
And I think we're really early in our understanding of that.
She notes that managing COVID patients requires the use of steroids, which cause elevated blood sugar levels. That's one of many factors that could have damaging effects on diabetics or someone with pre-diabetes.
So we know that we're probably seeing people who are very close to a diagnosis pass over that threshold and become diagnosed with diabetes.
Back home with her kids, Walston says that as a diabetic, this year has been rough physically and emotionally.
The best thing about 2020, not dying.
Doctors and scientists are working to understand the relationship between COVID-19 and diabetes. With rates of diabetes and pre-diabetes in the U.S. reaching epidemic levels, that's crucial to protect millions of Americans who are at the highest risk.
Why were you freaking out?
Because I didn't want my mom to die.
I wouldn't want my mom to die either.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Farah Yusri.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Indiana school districts and the schools themselves are trying, of course, to navigate the demands of virtual and hybrid and in-person learning and teaching. as they respond to the pandemic these days in real time. And organizations like an organization called Teach Plus, which normally works with teachers, experienced teachers, to help them learn how to take over leadership roles in some key policy and practice issues that in turn will affect student success in the classroom. The organization has put out a recent report, which is entitled Improving as We Go, Learning from Indiana District Reentry Plans. And of course, this is all dealing with schools going back into session during the pandemic. With us to talk about the report and about the organization is Rachel Hathaway. She is the Teach Plus Indiana Executive Director. And Rachel, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take a moment to explain more for people that are not familiar with Teach Plus, and in particular, how they've gotten involved in creating this report that's out there now.
Yeah, I'd love to. So we're a nonprofit that's focused on really empowering teacher voice in the classroom as well as at the policy level. We believe that educators are the folks who have the best understanding of what a classroom looks like, how policies and laws are impacting their daily lives. And so we really want to raise up their experiences so that they have a voice in decision-making processes when it comes to policies, when it comes to instruction. And so we run a fellowship that allows for educators to be trained on kind of that intro to policy, where they're thinking about their impact not only in the four walls of their classroom, which is where we want to keep them, but also what is their opportunity to grow and have an impact outside of those four walls. And so that's kind of our focus. And the way that we got into our report was that because we work directly with teachers and really work to try to elevate their voices and their experience, we've seen that as people were reapproaching to the return to schools, it was often coming from district level, right? So it was administrators doing what they could to set up a plan that then teachers were then responding to, as opposed to not always necessarily being a part of those conversations. And so looking at the district plans, we were also seeing a lot of variation because with guidance from the state, there was, you know, high level, this is what you could do, but we're really going to defer to you all at the local level. And so our hope was that by kind of digging into some of these district reentry plans, we could better understand what are some of the best practices, how are teachers feeling, do they feel well supported, and then elevate their experience and their voices in the process.
When did during the pandemic, did you folks have an opportunity to actually start gathering data together and in turn start you're consulting with teachers and the like and get the information together that is now part of the report?
So we've actually been in contact with our teachers since, you know, March and before that. And so there had been conversations where we were all just trying to figure out what's happening, where are we going from here. In June, we really started to do some virtual sessions where we brought our teachers together and had a little bit more structured conversation about, you know, some questions that they could reflect on, kind of be thoughtful of what it looked like for their concerns coming into that following school year. And so we conducted focus groups where we had about 50 Indiana teachers share their insights, share their thoughts. And then with that in mind, then embarked upon doing some more in-depth analysis with the actual reentry plans as they started to come out and were available later in the summer and into the fall. So with a combination of both the focus groups and then as these the analysis of the reentry plans, we were able to come forward with the findings and then really be thoughtful about how do we adjust this, right? How do we fill that gap and ensure that teacher voice is a part of these conversations? And how do we, knowing that everyone is kind of trying to do their best right now, right? Everyone is. District leaders, school leaders, teachers, we're all kind of flying by the seat of our pants. Mm-hmm. But how do we continue to improve that going from now with us 6 months into the school year? How do we continue to move forward to the end of the school year and really be thoughtful of improving based on what our teachers are actually experiencing? Since they're the ones who are on the front lines working directly with students and with their families, what are they learning? What's not going well? What's working well? Because we're also seeing positive things come from this moment in time, right? Mm-hmm. We're seeing innovations. We're seeing teachers step up and have opportunity to be creative and to find innovative solutions to meet the needs of their families. And we are seeing districts step up in ways as well, but it's how do we continue to raise up those best practices so that across the state we're having improved experience for not only our students, but for our teachers across districts.
We're talking with Rachel Hathaway. She is the Indiana Executive Director of the organization called Teach Plus. They put out a report which is entitled Improving as We Go, Learning from Indiana District Reentry Plans. And, of course, it's involving getting school districts back in session as the pandemic continues. If you will, Rachel, go into some detail here about some of the recommendations that you folks have made in the report.
Yeah. So the recommendations, we tried to be thoughtful, again, about having grace for where we're all in this together and we're all learning.
Right.
But, again, how do we continue to learn and improve as we're going forward? So our thoughts were around our teachers. They are stepping up in a big way to meet this moment. Some of them are working, 10-hour days. I've talked to some of our teachers where they said, I had to skip lunch and I only was able to eat a cheese stick at 10 a.m. in the morning, right? And finding that they've stepped up in ways that are not just about instruction, but about meeting the needs of their students, whether it's social and emotional, where they're, worried about their students' mental health and the gaps that are created by this pandemic, whether it's technical support, and some of our teachers are, learning on the fly how to be tech experts while also then facilitating their education. And the response has been excellent from partners in sense of, like, the Department of Education has put out a lot of different great resources. Lots of nonprofits have provided professional development resources. The challenge becomes that when we don't have the time for the teachers to take advantage of those professional development resources to then actually implement them, it creates overcapacity for our teachers. Mm-hmm. So even if they want to take and be developed, they don't have the time to actually implement, and it can create overwhelm. And so what we've put forward in some of our recommendations were, let's build in some more flexibility for that time. Let's be more thoughtful about thinking about instructional hours as opposed to instructional days, so that schools can be flexible in providing more professional development days or more unique scheduling so that it meets the needs of the students and the teachers. In addition to that, coming back to that mental health, we've seen not only for students but for teachers, we're seeing that mental health is all the more important in this moment of oddity. And so how do districts better support their mental health with their teachers? It's by providing access to resources. Earlier this year, I guess 2020, we passed a piece of legislation that allowed for, or now required, that school districts create MOUs to allow for support for student mental health. And our recommendation in that on the report is, can we then expand those MOUs to then include teacher mental support as well, mm-hmm. mental health support.
Now, you mentioned the General Assembly in this measure that got passed here. Are there any of the ideas and recommendations that are in the report that is out there now that you may ask lawmakers to take a look at when they come back into session here in January?
It's an interesting question. So there's been a lot of districts that we've seen take advantage of the recently passed HB 1003, I believe, that looks at the flexibility waivers for scheduling. And so you've seen districts actually acting on these recommendations already. We've just kind of put them forward and we're saying, yeah, this is the action. So it's kind of an affirming moment, right, when districts have already started to do this, and it aligns with the recommendations we've put out. So I think that there will be a question of how do we continue to create that flexibility, whether it's via legislation or if it's a continued use of these flexibility waivers. So that's one that I'd say would be interesting to see.
Mm-hmm.
And then to what I just spoke to, the student mental health
right.
or teacher mental health supports. I'm not quite sure what else is going to be covered over in session. I know funding is going to be a big, big, big question, right, as we're continuing to navigate the impacts of the coronavirus, as well as setting the two-year budget. Our hope is to continue to see, education funding supported. The commission for the governor's teacher pay report just came out yesterday, as I'm sure you saw, and it's got some extensive recommendations that we're still trying to process of that. I think there's some really positive things we've seen and some others that we have a few more questions. So I think it's just going to be a really intriguing session coming up, and our hope is that we can ensure that teacher voice is incorporated into that process.
That's probably the nicest way that anybody's been able to put how the General Assembly seems to work, that it's going to be a nice, interesting session, to say the least. now, let me ask, if anybody's interested in looking at the details in this report that is out there, how can they find out the information?
Yeah, they can find it on our website, which is teachplus.org, and go to our publications page, and you'll see it right at the top.
Rachel Hathaway is the Teach Plus Indiana Executive Director, and the organization has put out a new report, which is entitled Improving as We Go, Learning from Indiana District Reentry Plans, as we're dealing with getting education back underway in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. And Rachel, thank you very much for being with us to go over the report and explain, and we'll all watch the General Assembly very closely in this early year coming up and see if they do actually take care of some new of the issues that are taken up in the report. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Chris Boyd, host of Think. Think is a show for curious minds. Whether we're discussing history, science, politics, or the arts, my hope is that every conversation inspires curiosity and complexity, and that every listener walks away with their own questions, inspiration, and a thirst for more knowledge. Tune in and join me as we learn something new and take a moment to think.
Tune in today at 2 o'clock here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
My great-grandmother immigrated to the United States in 1922. She met my great-grandfather, Antonio Medina, in Indiana Harbor, and he was actually working in the United States in Missouri in 1917 to maybe 1923, 1924, and that's when he came to Indiana Harbor. There's different colonies, and they call themselves the colonies. I don't know if that was a prescribed notion to them. You know, we're kind of pioneers. We're starting off. We're a close-knit. So they were living in the Hull House area in South Chicago, Irondale neighborhood, South Chicago. My dad's mother was actually born in South Chicago, and her parents came from Mexico City. And they eventually moved to Indiana Harbor as well. And then Indiana Harbor and Gary. So those were the Mexican colonies. There's two waves that came into Indiana Harbor. And starting in 1919, there was the National Steel Strike. Before that, you already had Mexican populations working in agriculture and working on the railroad, because as the Transcontinental Railroad, you know, that was starting in Mexico going into the United States. And that's where my great-grandfather, Antonio Medina, started working, and that's why he was in Missouri. He was a section hand. So the first wave, so it came in 1919 with the Great Steel Strike. So they were being recruited off of the rail lines and the fields in the United States to work as strike breakers. Northwest Indiana is dotted with steel mills, primarily Inland Steel, which is now ArcelorMittal. Single men came to work, called solos, came to work in the steel mills in East Chicago. So you also have the Mexican Revolution, so there's always push and pull factors to immigration. And so 1910 and 1920 was the Mexican Revolution, which was huge. So Mexico was independent from Spain for about 100 years at that point, and so they were still operating in some of the ways when they were occupied by Spain. And so they were shedding their colonized roots to become an independent country. And one way that they did that started the Mexican Revolution was basically land reform, social and class warfare. You had a lot of families who owned haciendas. And haciendas, for lack of interpretation, is a large plantation. They were either agricultural, mining, or livestock, and some were like 500 acres, some were 500,000 acres, and they were basically land grants from Spain that were given to Spaniards to help populate the New World, New Spain, Mexico. And so those are passed down family to family. And so because of these, they were in rural areas, they were huge. And so there was a lot of social inequality, no real chance for upward social mobility. So your family could have lived for generations and died on the same hacienda. So the Mexican Revolution was basically busting up those haciendas and changing land reform and a lot of other things related to, becoming, what we know as modern day Mexico, because the Constitution changed as a result of that. So you have people who have worked on the natural rhythms of the hacienda, getting up in the morning, doing your work, and going to sleep at the same time, to coming to a heavily industrialized area, to making a lot more money than they probably would have ever imagined, and also different kind of work, working in hot and, you know, modern conditions. I would call steel mills modern. So you have a lot of solos who are coming in who are coming in to an already existing immigrant population. So there was a lot of Southern and Eastern European immigrants in Northwest Indiana. And so the second wave was in the earlier 1920s, where you have a lot of people coming from the counter-revolution of the Mexican Revolution. It was called the Cristero movement. And so one of the things that Mexico was doing was trying to lessen Catholic control of the country. And so there were anti-Catholic movements happening. So you see a lot of people coming into Indiana Harbor from the states of Jalisco and Guadalajara. And those were like middle-class families. So in the 1920s, you have this curious, fabulous mix of people from all different backgrounds, middle-class, low-class, all coming and mixing in the confines of Block and Pensy. They were racially segregated into these areas. Nobody would rent to them outside of these areas. So you do have a lot of people living in unsafe living conditions. I interviewed a gentleman who's now 101 years old, Fred Maravilla, and he talks about there was just no room. And his family lived in a garage. You know, they bought, as they call ticks, which are mattresses to stuff straw in to sleep. They would do their business in a pot and dump it out. You know, they were behind an apartment building. And then also multiple people were living in small clothes and confined places that the health department would just probably be aghast about. Being that this community was politically and economically weak, they began to start their own mutual aid societies, you know, helping to pay for like surgeries or ailments of the community, really to kind of like the community trust for the community. And then there were different social groups that came with that. You still had that, like, you know, the peasant, the haves and have nots. So the more educated people belonged to the Catholic Order of St. Joseph. That was like the more like literate. Some of those members there started a printing press, started a newspaper, had a library that they would share information. And then you had other societies like the Benito Juarez. I think it's the Benito Juarez Society, where people said that they were, you know, like blissfully illiterate, but, you know, but they all had shared their love for Mexico and wanting to preserve Mexican culture. So you just have like a delightful mix of people starting over fresh. And I think the notion was that we are Mexican, we'll always be Mexican first and maybe American second, but then also, you know, maybe there was some hope that they would go back once things settled down.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.